Welcome to Asia Pacific Defense Reporter, your go-to source for cutting-edge security insights in the region. Get ready for rapid-fire analysis and commentary from the Asia Pacific with your host, Kim Bergman.
Hello and welcome back. We've got a fair bit of stuff to get through today, so I'm going to get stuck right into it. And the first thing is, last Thursday, the 29th, I attended a launch of a policy document called the Defence Industry Development Strategy, done by Defence Industry Minister Pat Conroy. And page 11 of that document refers to a barrier to entry into the defence market, particularly of smaller companies, as being security concerns about the release of information about defence projects. Now, that also happens to be a long-standing complaint of the media. It's something that I've referred to repeatedly. Now, when I had the chance to ask the minister about this, and the transcript is online, he provided some very new information. He said that when it comes to the releasability of information, that is based on advice that the government receives from the security services. Now, this is brand new information for me. I had assumed up until now it was just the pig-headedness of ministers and their staff and maybe some senior bureaucrats, but to find out that Australia's security establishment is now providing advice on what can and can't go to the media and industry is another matter entirely. Now, put a placeholder there. I'm going to come back to that because on the very same night, the head of the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation, ASIO, Mike Burgess, gave his annual threat assessment. This is, I believe, the sixth year in a row. Now, I thought originally that this was kind of a typical Canberra bubble thing, but the reporting of the event has gone national because it contained, amongst other things, the revelation that a former politician, unnamed, had been recruited by a foreign intelligence service and was basically a traitor to Australia. Now, I'm going to return to that because it's a very important point. However, what I found really disturbing, reading the reports and watching a little bit of this event on television, was the theatrical nature of it. Now, I've never been invited to one of these things, and nor do I expect to be, and especially I won't be after I finished this commentary, because I previously thought that what would happen was some sort of normal roundtable briefing. You know, you release a paper and then you answer questions to journalists. But no, what it was a scripted speech using a teleprompter in a theatre in front of a hand-picked audience with applause. Now, I find that to be pretty close to inappropriate. I've been aware of ASIO most of my professional life. Many of us who work in Canberra do. And as a very young journalist, I covered every single day of the Hope Royal Commission into the Coombe Ivanov affair. I think I was about 12 at the time. Now, I do not doubt that there are countries and groups seeking to do Australia harm, especially in the cyber domain. But I have often wondered if our security services are looking in all the right places. I can elaborate on that perhaps in a future podcast. Anyway, this display by Mr. Burgess, from what little of it I have seen on TV and read about, was more like a single-person performance of Hamlet rather than a sober presentation by the head of a security agency. And I really thought that it was out of place. It's not the role of the head of an agency, to put on a piece of performance art full of confected one-liners designed to generate applause and approval. And he had talk of defeating the A-team. I must mention last year it was this "they were good but ASIO was better" rhetoric, which sounds like the self-congratulatory talk of the coach of a primary school football team. And the substance, and we'll get to the main point in a moment, seemed largely non-existent. Foreign operatives seeking information about the inner workings of political parties, well, You get that listening to Insiders on the ABC on a Sunday morning. Or, if you want even more detail, come to the Hotel Kingston on a Friday and listen to journalists, staffers, and lobbyists talk politics. Now, I find the idea that people having discussions on these topics with members of, you know, the diplomatic corps or businessmen or whatever to be a complete non-event. Now, the main point, the one that got all of the publicity publicity nationally, as for the so-called revelation of this politician who was a traitor, well, name him or her. It's rarely that I'm in agreement with Joe Hockey, but just leaving that out there smears everyone. Now, I see that Mr. Burgess and the government, to an extent, have been furiously backpedaling, because after the comment, it was then explained that, oh, well, this event, whatever it was, or this person was active before 2018. Well, in which case, why is it relevant? Why bring it up now? And how far back was it? 1950? Mr. Burgess talks about not wanting to compromise methods of intelligence gathering. Well, no one is asking you what the methods were. No one wants to know whether you bugged the person's car or had a video camera in their bathroom. We simply would like to know the name and something about the circumstances, and especially why weren't they charged at the time? Now, here's a quick question for all listeners. In the last 5 years, how many diplomats have been expelled from Australia for espionage? Okay. How many people have been charged with espionage? To the best of my knowledge, the answer is zero. On the other hand, people who have been charged are whistleblowers like David McBride, an Australian citizen trying to do the right thing and who now faces years behind bars. Now, it seems that ASIO in general, and well, the only person authorised to speak is the head, Mike Burgess, they are just completely unused to anyone questioning them, and I can assume that they must have been shocked by these demands that they name the politician accused of treason. The fact that Mr. Burgess can't or won't leaves open the possibility that the story is either a complete fabrication designed to boost ASIO's budget or make them look tough, or at the very least, it's a huge exaggeration. My bet is the latter. I bet that the origins were a relatively innocent series of comments by a politician to some diplomat that had been picked up and distorted and taken completely out of context. So I say to Mr. Burgess, I think you should either put up or shut up. And my bet is it's going to be a shut up. And I also bet he won't be doing this sort of thing again. And I also have to ask, where are my fellow journalists in all of this? A select handful were invited. But does anyone ask Burgess questions? Does anyone push back on this stuff? Or does everyone just sit there faithfully reporting these utterances word for word without any critical analysis of what they're hearing? Oh, and by the way, I looked for the speech, the assessment online, but it seems to have been removed. How Orwellian. Anyway, the bigger point is this. These same national security experts, who apparently from the same shadowy group advising defence not to release any useful information to journalists, are presumably the same group of dimwits telling the government not to reopen our embassy in Kiev, the fact of which is a national disgrace and an international embarrassment. I've spoken about that before. There are about 50 countries in the contact group with Ukraine. Australia remains the only one that has not reopened our embassy in Kiev, and the government hides behind, oh, well, we can't do it because the security services advise against. Now, which neatly takes us to a National Press Club address last Wednesday, which was one of the most moving and detailed presentations about the conflict in Ukraine that I think I've heard. certainly in Australia. They were from the ambassador, Vasil Marishnichenko, and the star of the show was a lady by the name of Katerina Guru. She is a member or a representative of the Ukrainian community groups in Australia. And both of them were very articulate, very moving. And for anyone interested in the Ukraine conflict, it is really worth listening to. It's only going to be about an hour out of your life. It's on YouTube. Really just go and check it out. And it was an impassioned appeal for Australia to do more. And I also, at that forum, had the opportunity to ask the ambassador a question, which was, given that Australians, and our army in particular, seems to have formed the view that Ukraine is some sort of, you know, medieval society with a primitive economy, how is it possible to support modern Western military systems like Taipan helicopters? Now, he shot that down pretty quickly, pardon the pun, explaining, amongst other things, that Ukraine has about 300,000 software engineers, and some of them, even right now, are doing contract work for Australian companies such as Atlassian. And he also spoke about the technology base of the country, and he pointed out the bleeding obvious that current operations, including things like successfully downing Russian aircraft, the most advanced in their combat fleet, and Ukrainian drones sinking major combatants of the Russian Black Sea fleet, shows that Ukraine is more than capable of supporting and operating advanced systems. And when it was her turn, Katerina made the further point that from the front line, Ukrainian soldiers can provide rapid feedback about how equipment is performing, and they would be able to supply Australia with very, very valuable information about what works and what doesn't work. And we would be getting all of that intelligence or all of that operational evaluation, to use the technical term, absolutely for free. Now, despite these passionate appeals for help, unfortunately, I fear once again that it's going to fall on deaf ears. Even though Defence Minister Richard Marles was sitting in the audience, nodding along approvingly at the speeches, I just don't get it. The government seems completely tone deaf on the issue of Ukraine and is undoubtedly less supportive than the coalition was, and I cannot understand why. Ukraine is fighting for its life. During all of World War II, 34,000 Australian soldiers died. In just 2 years, 33,000 Ukrainian soldiers have been killed. And our two countries have similar overall populations. So that gives you some idea of the terrible nature of the conflict. If Russia wins, Europe will be in turmoil, and in our region, dictators like President Xi of China will be emboldened. And we, Australia, we're not insulated from all of this. Now, if I were Vladimir Putin, in the middle of last year, when it became clear that the war would drag on, that his unprovoked invasion of Ukraine was a dismal failure, I would have called on Middle Eastern allies such as Iran and Syria to stir up as much trouble as possible, to distract the West in general and the US in particular. And wow, has that worked brilliantly. Now, maybe the Middle East is in turmoil purely coincidentally, but I somehow doubt it. And as you know, I'm not a particular conspiracy theorist. Now, for Australia, it's just money. That's all. And not very much money into the bargain. No people are being killed. The equipment that Ukraine wants is stuff that our army no longer wants. And I just don't get why we don't give it to them. Not just the Taipan helicopters, that's got a long way to run, but, you know, in the future, things like M1 Abrams tanks, air defense equipment, possibly ships. And in the next edition of APDR, which should be online about now, I've had a bit to say about the relationship between the Department of Defense and Richard Marles, which seems to have gone from an initial situation of mutual admiration to something far more ambiguous, with reports that Miles is unhappy with the department and that they are equally unhappy with them. I can't comment directly on that. They seem to be true from what I know. And I wonder if the Taipan debacle might have something to do with that. And while we're on Taipans, let's briefly talk about some Australian industry ramifications. With the retirement, Airbus Brisbane closed. That's 400 jobs, half of them Army veterans. The CAE simulators, I believe that the two in country, but they've presumably been removed or decommissioned or something. Safran has an engine support facility at Bankstown Airport that might also have to shut down. Main gearbox support. As recently as 2018, the federal government invested $16 million at Fisherman's Bend in a facility there, along with a similar amount from Leonardo. There are only three of these centres in the world. It looks now like it might shut just because of lack of work. Now, were any of these factors considered, discussed, brought in front of ministers? I mean, did Industry Minister Pat Conroy know anything at all about this when these catastrophic decisions were taken? If the helicopters instead had been transferred to Ukraine, some of the Australian supply chain might still have been involved. But thanks to the Australian Army and the government, we now get zero. I mean, well done, Army. What an achievement. Sully Australia's international reputation, achieved the worst capability outcome possible with no useful utility helicopters for close to half a decade, because it's going to take Black Hawks that long to come online, plus wreck industry prospects for ongoing Australian jobs. And that collectively is an extraordinary display of incompetence, and it is one that is fully supported by the government. Now, as I and other journalists and some politicians, getting to the bottom of this is not easy, but we're getting there. I'll give you an example. Senate estimates February 14th. I'll just read from the transcript. Senator Fawcett asks, "Its serviceability and availability and the Ukraine issue," speaking of Taipan, "all those things, who signs off on those briefs to government?" The Secretary, Mr. Moriarty, replies, "It does vary. Some submissions go through the CDF and me. Occasionally there'll be a brief from the CDF or me. At other times it will be another appropriate officer in the department. Often the CDF and I are copied in." Senator Fawcett continues, "Okay, let's be specific then. Regarding the briefs around the Ukrainian request for Taipan, who authorised those briefs to government in order to provide the ministers with talking points?" Another official, Mr. Jeffrey, cuts in, "As the Secretary have said, it does vary, so we'd need to take it on notice. Sometimes I can be signing the brief, sometimes it can be from the head of military strategic commitments. If it's a specific operational item, and sometimes, I mean, blah, 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 you know, give me a break. In other words, no one is responsible and everyone is responsible." Well, departmental and army officials, that's not good enough, and you can keep trying to hide, but the truth is going to come out. Now, circling back to the security services, this is kind of a recurrent theme. So they advise not releasing basic information to journalists when it is often publicly available elsewhere, particularly from sources in the United States. It's the same people advising the government not to reopen the Kiev embassy. Well, I say, when you put all of that together, maybe it's time to have a review of those security services, or simply ignore their advice when it's patently ridiculous. They are hardly infallible, as Mr. Burgess has so amply demonstrated. Now, once again, I'm running out of time. I had been hoping to cover a little bit more to do with AUKUS, also Labour opinion polls and how national security is perceived. We will do that next week. As always, thank you for listening and goodbye for now.
That's today's Asia Pacific Defence Reporter. For more in-depth articles, expert opinions, and exclusive interviews, visit asiapacificdefencereporter.com. Stay informed, stay ahead. This is your source for all things defence. Until next time.